I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Dean Radin, who is the chief scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, as well as a distinguished associate professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies. For almost four decades, Dr. Radin has been researching the frontiers of consciousness, as well as parapsychology, commonly known as psi research. He has held appointments at the AT&T Bell Labs, Princeton University, University of Edinburgh, Stanford Research Institute, and was also a scientist conducting highly classified research on psychic phenomena for various governmental agencies. He has lectured widely throughout the world. His earlier book, The Conscious Universe, was one of the most important books on Amazon dealing with parapsychology and received the Scientific and Medical Network's Best Book Award. His most recent book is entitled Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and a Guide to the Power of the Universe, which has received endorsements from two Nobel laureates in science. His website is Dean Radin, R-A-D-I-N, .org. And the topic we're going to discuss is the scientific evidence to support the underlying principles of magic and why this will be part of the new frontier of science and human potential. Nice to have you with us today, Dean.
Thank you, Gary. I'm happy to be here.
We're going to continue our conversation that we began last month to look at how the leading edge of science is starting to converge upon the ancients of the, let's say, 1,000 years ago or longer. And during all of that time, our ancestors perceived consciousness as the fabric of their world. Consciousness was fundamental to their worldview. Then something happened during the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, and our rational faculty started to displace our inherent intuitive and spiritual senses, such as precognition and clairvoyance. And I had watched a debate between Dr. Alan Wallace, a wonderful Buddhist professor and teacher who also was a person with degrees in physics, and Sean Carroll, an astrophysicist at the University of California, who is one of the popular spokespersons for the extreme skeptic movement, along with Sam Harris and Jerry Coney. Carroll's argument was that science already knows everything it needs to about quantum physics. Therefore, if anything new appears that seems contrary to it, such as non-localized consciousness or parapsychology, then it's highly plausible that it is false, bogus. And I'm thinking how completely unscientific that kind of view is. The hubris in saying we know everything we need to know about physics is ridiculous. Of course, looking at biological systems such as our bodies and brains from the perspective of quantum or biophysical theories is still in its infancy. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but for this new audience, please summarize what happened to the world of magic and esoteric sciences with the advent of the Enlightenment, and in what areas is modern science today now making a full circle and starting to validate in the laboratory what the ancients knew all along. The form is yours.
Well, it's not clear that what the ancients knew is different than even what we today think of as knowing something. So if we know something in a scientific sense, it means that we have instruments and we can make measurements and make hypotheses which are testable under controlled conditions and all of the rest of the scientific method. And we know that much of what has been discovered in science has turned into technologies, and those technologies in many ways define the modern world. So we have to be careful not to easily dismiss the scientific worldview because there are too many things telling us that it's correct. And so I think that people like Sean Carroll are enthralled, as maybe we should be, by the success of science. But unfortunately, sometimes the awe and an amazement of the power of science to begin to understand the nature of reality, it also creates blinders. And so the blinders in this case are, I think, reflected by what ancient peoples knew. And this is, by the way, it's not just ancient peoples, because much of the esoteric literature and concepts are still very present with us today. They're just seen in different ways. So science is very powerful. It is a valid method of testing the way the physical world works, but it absolutely does not explain everything. And it, most importantly, it doesn't explain the only thing that we will ever know, and that is our own awareness. This is now talking about a philosophical difference about what you think reality is made of. And a philosopher would say it's a tension between materialism and idealism. So materialism is the notion that everything is made of matter and energy, including the mind. This is a popular notion in the neuroscientists today that equates brain activity with consciousness. The flip side is idealism, which is popularly associated with Eastern philosophy, but there's a long tradition in Western philosophy too, and this is the other side of materialism. So idealism says that everything is made out of mind or consciousness, including matter and energy. So you can see then that these are two ends of a spectrum in terms of ways of thinking about the nature of reality. So the esoteric traditions, which goes all the way back to shamanism, so it's back into the misty past of human history, that was essentially an idealistic perspective. It assumed that that somehow consciousness was fundamental. That's the phrase that you see again and again as a synthesis of what the esoteric traditions were all about. And there are many names for these esoteric traditions. Let me just give a little list here to give you a sense of what we're talking about. So if we go back far enough, we start with shamanism. And by the way, everything I'm going to mention here is still present today. There are lots of people who are studying shamanism today, not only the scholarly methods, but the practice of shamanism. So that never really went away, and most indigenous peoples on the earth today still have shamans. So we jump from that to perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 years later to the Greek philosophers. And by the way, I'm focusing mainly here on the Western esoteric tradition, because if you could also take an Eastern approach, which looks more at the traditions within Asia, which are somewhat different. And I looked at that in a previous book called Supernormal, which was focusing on yoga and meditation. But my current book, Real Magic, is most on the Western esoteric tradition. So it more or less starts with shamanism, but then we jump way into the future, up to Pythagoras. And then Plato, about 500 years after Plato, a worldview called Neoplatonism, and also Gnosticism, the Kabbalah, Hermeticism. And then we're coming up into the Middle Ages with the Knights Templar, the Freemasons, quite a bit later, the Rosicrucians. And then Madame Blavatsky created Theosophy, which was an attempt to synthesize the esoteric traditions as of about 150 years ago. That gave rise, or about at the same time, to the Golden Order of the Order of the Golden Dawn, which was a resurrection of ancient ceremonial magic that led to a method developed by a guy named Peter Carroll called chaos magic. Around the same time or just before then was Aleister Crowley, who was a modern ceremonial magician. We also need to consider people like Mesmer, the development of Christian Science, the development of new thought religions. And it brings us up to the present day with books on affirmations, positive psychology. And while most of the, I mean, if you go into a bookstore and you look at the genre of affirmations, there are dozens and dozens of books on this. Power of Positive Thinking is just one of many books like this. And these books are among the most popular books ever. Like within the area of affirmations literature, it's competitive with religious books. And religious books typically are the ones that are most sold, but this area of literature is also extremely popular. And so if you go through that entire literature with the goal of figuring out, is there something similar which is being discussed? And scholars tend to focus on differences. They're interested in the nuances, the differences between Neoplatonism and Gnosticism, for example. And there are some differences, but I was interested in the similarities. So if you do that exercise and look through this, the similarities across these perhaps 10,000 years or more of human history, it all boils down to three words. Consciousness is fundamental. Perhaps one of the best books on this topic was written by Aldous Huxley called The Perennial Philosophy. Even this idea of a perennial philosophy echoes back through history, and scholars have often thought, as scientists do today, that there's one underlying way of thinking about how everything fits together. So a physicist today wants to figure out the theory of everything. And so from their perspective, they're trying to figure out a underlying physical way of thinking about literally everything, the whole universe, how we fit in it, the whole thing. So that's theories of everything. But the ancients had the same idea. But given that they weren't starting from a materialistic point of view, their theories of everything essentially converged on the notion of awareness or consciousness as the only thing we actually can know directly. So the other origin of the esoteric traditions were mystical experiences. So generally in the Eastern world, meditation was a route to the mystical experiences. Also, everybody throughout history has used psychedelics to get there. And this is true in the East and the West. And mystics, when you look at the raw experience, again, the similarities as opposed to the differences, they all basically say the same thing. That if you go into a deep enough state of consciousness, you come to the realization that something about your awareness is universal. That is the mystical experience. You and the universe are the same in some way. And more than that, that the physical world as it appears and how we experience it is deeply dependent on the nature of consciousness. So that's a very fast review of esotericism, which, by the way, is a fast-growing domain within academia today. There are societies for the study of esoteric traditions. There's
Dean,
at least one... Yes?
What I'd like to do is bring this conversation to a level with examples that the average person can understand, so it's not so existential. Let me give you an example from my own background.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested as a scientist, a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology and Anti-Aging Medicine, but also had a quiet passion for doing psi research. And there were not many places that a person could actually have a laboratory, a high-quality lab, 16 different departments, to do this kind of research. It was shunned. It was not considered legitimate science. It was kind of like voodoo science. But I had hundreds of highly respected physicians and scientists asked me, could we do some research there? And I would listen to their ideas, and more often than not, I'd say, fine. And what I did was I believed that people could transmit energy, and exchanging energy is one of the basis of all healing. A mother, a mother cooing and singing a melody to her baby. That's exchanging energy. It alleviates stress in the child. When she breastfeeds, that alleviates stress and encourages a better immune development. And even when a baby's in the womb, a mother massaging her belly and thinking positive thoughts and affirmations can, again, harmonize the health of the child as it's developing. And we also know the opposite is also true. You can't have half of a reality. So I got 50 people together who claimed that they could all help channel an energy into a mouse and cause that mouse's tumor to regress. Well, this did not include theatrics or any kind of sleight of hand, and therefore it made it much more legitimate. It took us 2 years to do this experiment, but we finally ended up with 50 people who claimed to have had, and the best we could understand did, that wasn't easy to validate it. And at the end of that period of time, five individuals were able, in every single instance, there was a doctor, Thomas Carruth, the Order of St. Luke, there was Rabbi Abraham Wiseman, there was Dr. Loris Krieger, head of nursing at New York University Medical School, Dr. Audrey Carger, and Dr. Morton Jacobs. And he was known as the chiropractor with healing hands. So they were able to do 5 out of 5 experiments with the same identical results. So from a scientific perspective, they had proved a gold standard. It wasn't something other people could not appreciate. But then getting that information out was the key. And during this period of time, there was a sixth person, Dr. Harry Edwards, who headed the Spiritual Society of Great Britain. And I wanted to know more about what they were doing in Great Britain. So I took a camera crew. I actually hired a cameraman from the BBC working in his off hours, moonlighting. And I took a group of scientists, and I took a person. His name was Michael, who had been paralyzed in a swimming accident for his whole adult life. Now, he was functional. He could function, but he couldn't bend over and touch his toes. There are a lot of things he couldn't do. He was wearing a brace at all times. And we went to Dr. M. Woolley Hart, Dr. Christopher Woodard. Now, these are very respected mainstream Orthodox medical doctors in Great Britain, what are called Harley Street physicians, and there were about 7 of them that we interviewed. They all tried. None of them succeeded in making a difference with Michael. And during this period of time, I heard about a man who was well known within the Spiritualist Society of Great Britain. And there was a gathering. They would do seances and readings. And most people that I spoke with said, "That's all nonsense, trickery. Houdini exposed as being trickery." I said, "Okay, maybe it is trickery. I just want to see what they do." This man was not into that. But at one particular seance, there was a person called the Silver Birch. Now, who he was never fully identified, but there was a man named Brice Barbanel who published the Psychic News that had a small but a substantial following. And he did a series of, let's say, transcriptions of this Silver Birch's teachings. And I bought the book at one of these psychic bookstores called The Teachings of the Silver Birch. Now, on its own, it's just a very good motivational book. There's nothing in it that's that extreme. It talks about a positive look at life. If Gandhi's name had been on it, it would have been apropos. It was that kind of inspiration. So even if there was nothing more than just a clever person writing a book of affirmations to make people feel good about themselves, it certainly fit the bill. But I saw a lot of things I could not explain at the time, and I was told that there was this one man who ran these sessions that I should go and speak with him. So my office contacted him and set up an appointment, so I took the train out into the countryside, and I got to this beautiful, I mean absolutely bucolic English estate. I went inside, a woman showed me in and set me in a room. And I looked out this gorgeous window to this backyard that was just probably about 10, 15 acres with trees and Shakespearean gardens with flowers. And the room was very quiet. But I noticed there was also a man sitting, looked like he was meditating over in a corner. And I thought we were both waiting and to go see this other person. Well, after about 2 hours, a woman comes in and says, "I'm sorry, but that's all the time you have." I said, "But I haven't met the person. I came clear out here to meet them." They said, "I'm sorry." I felt very disappointed, so I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to, you know, say anything obnoxious, so I just left. And all the way back in the train, I was having this conversation in my mind, what I would have said, what I would have asked him. Well, the next night, I believe it was 33 Belgravia Square. That was a very exclusive area of London, and a friend of mine owned a house there, so I was staying at his house as a guest. I'm walking down the street, and I see a sign outside that this person was going to do a lecture, the very person that I wanted to go see. So I thought, okay, so I went in, and it was packed. I'm guessing 100 people in this room, and up comes the guy to talk, and lo and behold, it was the same guy who was in the room with me. And when he began to talk, it was the same voice that I had had in my head there and on the train back. And boy, if you don't think that didn't grab my attention, that grabbed my attention. So anyhow, the study became positive. My trip there became a real sense of insight, and I had a whole new respect for the idea of being motivated to accept that there are esoteric practices in this world that we are not in the West prepared to even understand. So my question is this. I'd like for you to briefly explore the three major subjects that are associated with esoteric practices, the divination, and this would include our faculties of attention or motivation and intention, and the use of our will. Usually we associate this with different kinds of astrology or card reading, and the Chinese I Ching. But what would be a scientific way to describe this kind of esoteric practice, such as intuiting or divining events before they occur, knowing something is going to occur before it does, and what have been some of the experiments conducted to validate its efficacy?
Okay. The reason that I was talking about the history of esoteric ideas is because that's over 10,000 years old, whereas scientific methods are roughly 300 or 400 years old. And the distinction then, and to bring it back to why many scientists today dismiss the idea of esotericism, is because they don't know the history of it. They don't know that that science today actually was developed and sits upon many of the concepts of esoteric ideas, including, as you're mentioning now, the magical practices. So I make an analogy like technology today is the practice of the scientific worldview. It's an application or a practice of the worldview today. Magic is the application of esoteric ideas. That's the analogy. So you mentioned divination as one of those practices. Well, divination is perception through space and time, or space or time. If it's perception through space, we give the label clairvoyance or remote viewing. And if it's perception through time, we use words like precognition. You mentioned that the practices involve the I Ching or tossing of runes or mirror gazing and crystal ball gazing, all of that sort of stuff. The question is whether those practices are real or hallucinatory. So in the laboratory, let's say you wanted to test whether precognition is real. The simplest possible way is to have somebody guess what the toss of a die would be. It's going to be 1 through 6. You ask somebody, well, what do you think is going to show up? They give a number, and then you toss the die. So the event is in the future. The only way you can systematically get it correctly is by precognition, because by definition, nobody knows yet what the result is going to be. So that general idea has been used many, many times in different contexts in laboratory studies. And you look at the overall results of those kinds of guessing games. Statistically speaking, it's very clear that people can do this task, but to a very small degree. So we can only see it generally as statistical results that are not chance. They're beyond chance. Starting about 20 years ago, colleagues and I developed a new kind of method which didn't require people to consciously guess, because it turns out that their everyday conscious awareness is not the best state to be in order to do these kinds of tasks. It requires a contact with a deeper part of your consciousness. So we use physiological methods where we would record measures like heart rate and skin conductance and pupil dilation, brain activity, and so on. We'd use those measures as a way of indirectly telling what's going on in the person's unconscious. So these are measures that are happening all the time, of course. Your heart rate will accelerate and decelerate. Oftentimes, you have no idea. You have no conscious idea that that's happening. But it's reflective of how you're responding to things around the world that you're simply not aware of. So the experiment works like this. We wire somebody up to measure some aspect of their physiology. We sit them down in front of a computer that will, the monitor will show a picture that is selected at random from a large pool of pictures. And the pictures are part of an international standardized set that are specifically designed to evoke emotion. So there are three types of emotions. One is neutral, like a picture of a tree or a picture of a table, something that doesn't evoke much emotion, or highly emotional positive, which could be like a smiling baby or a puppy or an erotic picture. These are all positive emotions. Or highly negative, like a picture of an airplane crash or house burning or something like that. So you don't know in advance what kind of an emotional picture you're going to see. You press a button, and 5 seconds later, the computer selects one of the pictures, shows it to you for 3 seconds, the picture goes away, and then you relax for 20 seconds or so. And you do this repeatedly for perhaps 20 minutes. So you might see 30 or 40 pictures over the course of the experiment. And what the experiment is looking for is, are you unconsciously aware of what the future picture is going to be, even though nobody knows in advance what each picture is going to be in the experiment? And we would detect that, this unconscious knowledge, we would detect it by looking at changes in physiology before the picture arises. So the hypothesis specifically is that before you see an emotional picture, your body begins to gear up as though you've already seen an emotional picture. And before you see a calm picture, your body will remain calm. And again, body is reflective of your unconscious awareness. So that experiment has been done now over 40 times, about 4 dozen times, in different labs around the world, using different physiological measures, different kinds of stimuli, sometimes pictures, sometimes sounds. And there's no doubt, when you look at the overall body of experiments, that even under these highly controlled conditions, that the body, the human body, responds before an event actually occurs. So this actually, in terms of the size of the effect, this is a much stronger effect than you would get if you were simply asking people to consciously guess what is about to happen. So this is just one example of how we know that these ancient practices, which used to be called magic, like divination was a magical practice, well, we can now do experiments in the lab and confirm that the idea of divination is actually true.
Let's take that a little further then, please. I would like for you to talk about the use of force of our will and our power of intention to manifest something. Since my primary focus in life has been health and healing, including working with energy or energy medicine, I have a strong interest in how our will and concentrated intentions can bring about positive change in our environment, in treating disease, and how to live a more productive life. So please share some of the results of experiments you have conducted to support the paranormal attributes of our will, and what will be the scientific rationale for the mind exerting an effect on matter.
Okay, so force of will or manifestation is the second primary form of magical practice. So in the laboratory, well, of course, the idea is, as you described, that something about intention and imagination and motivation seem to be able to push the world around, not only your own body, which we typically will think of as the placebo effect, but we also see that mental intention can change the behavior of physical objects at a distance. So in the lab, this started out also using dice. And by the way, this goes all the way back to Francis Bacon, who was considered the father of modern empiricism back in the Enlightenment. So this goes back several hundred years to the origins of science itself. He recommended the tossing of dice to test what he called the force of imagination, which we would call manifestation. And also, the toss of dice is convenient because you can use very simple statistics to figure out whether it's not simply like precognition where you're trying to guess what the future target is, but you want, say, face four to show up with a die. So you intend that, and somebody throws the die, and you see whether or not it shows up. So starting in the 1930s, dice were used pretty extensively. A meta-analysis of experiments, all of the experiments using dice. I did the meta-analysis back in the 1990 or so, and it was very clear that those experiments worked. Again, that means a very small effect that you need statistics in order to see, but when you figure out the odds against chance, there was basically no doubt that when people were intending that a certain die face show up, that it did. So that's more or less the origins of those kinds of experiments. And since then, targets like the growth of bacteria and different cell cultures and small animal health and behavior, human health and behavior, electronic circuits, many, many different kinds of physical targets, both animate and inanimate, have been the target of mental intention to see if your intention can change something in the world. So most of my own research has involved the use of electronic random number generators. These are devices that are essentially electronic coin flippers. They can generate zeros and ones very quickly and very randomly. And you use that as a target where you ask people to see if you can mentally cause this thing to generate more ones or generate more zeros. And to make a very long story short, the answer is yes. That statistically, yes, you can see that you can bias a random system to act more leaning towards ones or leaning towards zeros. So I've done many experiments like that, and there's several hundred that have been published by myself and many colleagues around the world. And there, too, when you look at all of the experiments, it's very clear that what's going on is not due to chance. It's also important to point out that in these experiments, there's a long due diligence list to make sure that what you're seeing is not an artifact. It's not a mistake or a loophole or something like that. So these experiments are as tight as anybody knows how to make. So the force of will from a magical perspective, several different factors were thought to influence the effect, and one important one was belief. And in any magical practice, in order for the effect to actually work, required that you believe that it would work. And so we tested this in an experiment where we had three Buddhist monks in a Buddhist temple in Taiwan bless water through intention. And then the water was used to make tea, and the tea was separated into two batches. 100 people were randomly assigned some of the tea, or the control tea, which was not blessed, and 100 were assigned the blessed tea. Now, the blessing that we asked the monks to put into the water was that anybody who drank it would have an elevation in their mood, and they'd feel less fatigue. So we have the blessed tea, we have the control tea from the same batch, we have the 100 people in both conditions, double-blind experiment, and at the end of each day, over the course of 1 week, all of the participants would record their mood using a standardized mood reporting scale. During the three middle days of the week, they would drink this tea. And so, of course, people didn't know if they had the control tea or the blessed tea. So what we found overall with the placebo control is the placebo control is saying that these are everybody who thought that they were drinking the blessed tea. Of course, they didn't know if they were or not, but they thought they were. So this controls for placebo expectation. But the people getting the blessed tea actually got a statistically significant improvement in their mood. So that's like the standard placebo-controlled experiment. So it worked. The blessing worked. But then we separated out people according to their belief and then matched it against what they actually were getting. And what we saw was that for people who got the blessed tea and believed that they were getting the blessed tea, they got a very strong result, very strong positive improvement in their mood. But people who got exactly the same blessed tea but didn't believe it, they got no effect at all. And so that matches this lore that comes out of the esoteric traditions, that in order for a magical practice to work, you have to believe that it's going to work. So this fits into just conventional psychology now, that your belief modulates essentially what you allow in yourself, what you allow to exist. So you can modulate even magic. If you strongly don't believe in magic, then you don't get any magic. And this may explain why some people are so skeptical about this, that they're skeptical beyond simple doubt, skeptical to the point where they basically don't want it. They don't want to see this stuff happen. And the likelihood is then that it won't. For them, it won't. If you don't want it to happen, you can block it. If you do want it to happen, it'll happen.
I recall an earlier time you were on the program, it's at least several years ago, you discussed a study you had published. It had to do with different healers praying or meditating on chocolate that was then distributed to the study's participants. I recall it was a blind placebo trial and the results were statistically significant.
Right.
Would you describe that study again and scientifically in the context of consciousness as something far greater than one's own brain's neurochemistry, how would you account for these results?
Right. So there's two questions there. So one is, does it work? And the other one is, how does it work? So the chocolate experiment is very similar to the one involving tea. The chocolate experiment was a Buddhist monks and a Mongolian shaman intentionally affected or blessed pieces of chocolate, and then there was controlled chocolate from the same batch, and we recruited people to have the chocolate without knowing what they didn't know which kind they were getting. And again, we recorded mood as a way of seeing whether there was a change. And the people getting the treated or the blessed chocolate had reported improved mood. So now the question is, given that we've seen both changes in mood based on a blessing of food or water. We've also done experiments with the same Buddhist monks in Taiwan targeting water, which was then used to grow plants, little mustard seed plants. And we got a very significant increase in the growth. They were much healthier plants that got the blessed water as compared to the control water. Well, why does that happen? If you take the scientific worldview today, which is based on materialism, it cannot happen because an intention simply would be thought of as something that your brain is doing, And there's no way that's understood about how something happening in your brain can influence something like the growth of seed or the changes in mood or how it would affect water or chocolate or anything else. That's why you find that from a mainstream scientific perspective today, these kinds of effects, even though they use standardized, gold standard methods, they're generally not paid much attention to because we don't know how to explain it. This is exactly why I started looking into the esoteric traditions to look for clues as to how we can understand it, because the scientific worldview doesn't seem to be adequate. So to go back then, the whole point of esoteric traditions is that consciousness is fundamental. That's completely the opposite from the scientific worldview, where matter is fundamental or energy is fundamental. So if we go back to something like blessing of tea, why would that make any difference? From an esoteric tradition, since consciousness is fundamental, it means that consciousness comes prior to the physical world and influences and maybe even creates the physical world. In fact, from a mystical perspective, the physical universe emerges from consciousness. Since we all have consciousness, then the idea of parts of the physical world or aspects of the physical world emerging out of our own awareness, well, this is what the esoteric traditions say. That's the way it is. That's simply how the world works. So if I intentionally bless water, I'm doing something to that. My awareness is changing the nature of the water in a way that matches what my goal is. So in terms of going a little bit deeper into that to figure out, well, how does consciousness do that? We don't know. The ancients didn't know either. Even the mystics didn't know how it would work, how that would work. But if it's true that the basic premise is correct, that the physical world is emerging somehow out of consciousness, then at least opens the door for a way of understanding why any kind of psychic experience or mystical experience, or for that matter, magical experience, why it would work. So I then take the next step in my book to say, well, is there any evidence in science from a theoretical perspective as to the idea that somehow the physical world is emerging out of awareness? And it turns out that the answer is yes. And so here's the point about the magic is the future of science. The notion is that when you look at thought leaders at the leading edge in mathematics, in the neurosciences, in physics, they're all beginning to say the same thing. They're saying, for a mathematician would say that mathematics is reality. It's not describing reality, it is reality. A physicist would say that from a physics perspective that information is the basis of reality. A neuroscientist will be talking about how consciousness does not seem to be compatible with the notion of it arising somehow out of 3 pounds of neural tissue in your head. It doesn't match somehow. A linguist might say that reality is made of symbols. So when you start mixing all of these leading-edge ideas now, all from prominent mainstream scientists, it starts to look much, much closer, much more similar to what the ancients said based on esoteric ideas, namely that there's something peculiar about information, symbols, mathematics, which after all is just a symbolic language. It's like language is creating reality itself. Even in the Bible, the notion of God creates everything from a word, well, it's like symbols somehow. We live in a symbolic reality. The other line of thought now, which is more popular in computer science, is that we live in a simulation. We live in the Matrix, basically. So these are all leading-edge ideas. The idea that we live in a simulation is taken very seriously by many people today. And it's all compatible then with the esoteric ideas. So that's why I make the claim in my book, Real Magic, that where we're heading is a convergence between these very ancient esoteric ideas and leading edge of science. So when the convergence meets, I can't quite say, maybe we're 20 years away or 100 years away, but I think at some point that what we used to call magic will eventually become part of what we call science.
Okay, I appreciate that answer. Thank you. The third subject is called theurgy, T-H-E-U-R-G-Y, which became a highly developed esoteric discipline in ancient Greece and Egypt. And it's something common to all traditional shamanic traditions. Please explain theurgy, both in its classical and ancient context, and then how it might be described scientifically today, and what are some of the experiments that show there may be some truth behind it?
So theurgy comes from two Greek words, the roots meaning basically God work or divine work. It refers to the idea that there are spirits, invisible, intelligent spirits out there that might be departed humans, they might be nature spirits, but some kind of intelligence that generally most people cannot see. Some people can see them, or at least they claim that they can see them. Those are called the shamans or the seers. So it's true that most ceremonial magic, at least the way it's portrayed in entertainment, is focused on the idea of evoking or conjuring up spirits to do something on your behalf. And there are traditions, and the Jewish tradition has the idea of a golem, Tibetan tradition has the idea of a tulpa. There are lots of traditions which take a hunk of dirt and imbue it with a spirit, and that then it animates. You can animate it, almost like a Frankenstein. So there are long traditions about these ideas. Mediums today, of course, specialize in the idea of talking to deceased people. So, fortunately now, we have a way of testing not whether the spirits actually exist. That's beyond what science is able to do at this point. What we can do, though, is study in mediumship, in channeling, and in near-death experience, and what's called after-death experiences, a variety of different ways of looking indirectly at the notion that there's invisible spirits of some type. So to give an example from mediumship, we've worked with mediums in two ways so far. The first is to, under double or triple blind conditions, to have a medium do a reading for a client. So the client typically wants to know something about their departed Uncle Bob, say. And so if you have the client sitting with the medium, which is how it's generally done in a clinical setting, the medium can tell all kinds of interesting things about departed Uncle Bob, and their experience is that they're talking to Uncle Bob, or they can see Uncle Bob. But from a scientific perspective, that's immediately people would say, well, they're just guessing, and they're using cold reading techniques to adjust what they're saying so it matches what the client wants to hear. Well, that's not suitable for an experiment. So when we do this for under experimental conditions, the medium never gets to see or hear anything from the client. All they know is that a client wants to hear about Uncle Bob, and that's all they know. And then they might may be talking to somebody who's sitting in front of them, but we call that a proxy sitter. So the sitter is the client. The proxy is that the person sitting in front of them, they don't know who Uncle Bob is either. But they're the ones who said, well, I have somebody who wants to know about Uncle Bob. So the medium talks to the proxy. So you create a transcript, everything that the medium says about Uncle Bob. And now you come in with another person who says, I want to hear about Uncle George. So the medium gives a reading about Uncle George. You create a new transcript. And now you go back to the two people who wanted to hear about Bob and George, but you remove any names on the transcript. So you can't tell whose reading was for who, but the clients have to rank, and they have to judge the two transcripts to say, well, yeah, this one's very similar to what I knew as Uncle Bob, but this transcript doesn't sound like Uncle Bob at all. And so if you do repeated trials like this, you're able to, after a while, to see whether the mediums are getting verifiably correct information that match what the clients know about their departed loved ones. And so those experiments have been done by ourselves and by colleagues under double and triple blind conditions, and it shows that mediums can do this. So what the mediums experience is they're talking to a dead person. We can't verify, but we can verify that the information that they're getting is correct. So we took the next step, which was to take EEGs, 32-channel EEGs, while the mediums were thinking about their doing the mediumship under four conditions. One was actually mentally doing mediumship. Another was simply imagining that they were talking to Uncle Bob, not doing mediumship, but just using pure imagination. A third was to listen to a story about Uncle Bob. And the fourth was just relaxing. And we wanted to see whether just overall brain activity was the same or different in these four conditions. And it turns out they're different. In particular, brain activity while doing actual mediumship is different than imagining that they were talking to Uncle Bob. So this rules out that they were simply imagining it or hallucinating it. So the next step was we noticed when we talked to mediums about their experience that they could look at a photograph and very quickly get an impression about whether this person was alive or departed. Within a second or so, they just get the impression, yeah, this person's alive, that person's deceased. So we did an experiment, first of all, to confirm, after looking at a photograph for a few seconds, were they correct? Could they actually tell the difference between somebody in a photograph who was alive, presently alive, or dead? And the answer is yes, they could do that. And at the same time they were doing the experiment, we were also taking EEG measures to see if unconsciously they also knew this. In other words, when they have to respond, yes, I think they're alive, or yes, I think they're dead, that's a conscious response. But all of these experiments have tell us again and again that the information that you use to make a conscious decision is already present in your unconscious before you're aware of it. So we looked at brain activity 100 milliseconds after a photograph appears on the screen. And 100 milliseconds is before you're consciously aware of what you're going to say, or at least before you're consciously aware of what you're going to respond to. And we find that 100 milliseconds before the image comes up, if the image was of a deceased person, that your brain is responding differently. If you're about to say yes and you were correct, or you're about to say, yes, I think they're deceased, and you were wrong. So some aspect of yourself actually knows that you're wrong, even though you might consciously make the wrong decision, we can see that you unconsciously know that. At least the mediums did. We don't get the same result. Yes?
Dean, I have one final question, because we're coming up to only 2 minutes left in the program.
Okay.
Some years ago, there was an experiment, I believe, by Dr. Yamamoto, who claimed that a group of Buddhist priests could meditate on a drop of water and affect the structure of the drop using words like love or peace. And he was substantially challenged, and the skeptics said he was completely debunked. Could you tell us about that? Because that's the first a lot of people thought about the intention altering physical reality.
Right, so that was Dr. Emoto, and it's true that he wrote books and gave lectures about the effects of happy words making water crystals beautiful and ugly words making it look ugly. So after one of those lectures, I asked Dr. Emoto if he would be willing to do a double-blind experiment where there was water that was blessed and water that was not blessed. They would crystallize it, and so on. But they didn't know what condition the water was. And he agreed. So we did an experiment with him where we supplied the water, some of which was blessed and others were not. His technician crystallized the water. We took photographs of the crystals, and then asked people on the internet, and many, many judges, I forget how many, about 1,000 or so, looked at each crystal picture and simply judged, do you think this is beautiful or not? And the results confirmed what Dr. Emoto was saying, but as we often find, the effect size, the magnitude of the effect was much, much smaller than what he typically would show. So when he would do a book or a presentation, he would show really beautiful crystals with the implication that that always happened, and that is not the case. But on average,
okay,
it was correct. We then followed that up with a triple-blind experiment, and we got, again, the same result. So his idea was correct, but the magnitude of the results were much smaller.
All right, we're out of time. Dr. Dean Radin, thank you very much. His website is deanradin.org. His book is Real Magic, Ancient Wisdom, Modern Science, and the Guide to the Power of the Universe. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and here today. Oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.